Karen Smith here, and welcome back to part two of looking at our six team dysfunctions. Already we're at lesson 29, and I'm sure in some ways you're looking forward to the end of this whole series, but this lesson I think you're going to still continue to find very exciting and very useful. And I believe that you'll begin to see more clearly and feel the extraordinary potential that lies latent most of the time within teams. But what we're doing here is trying to unearth this latent potential. So what we looked at first was why take the time to make teams work. We looked at the first dysfunction that I called backward positioning. And it's more of an attitudinal dysfunction that sets our perspective and read on almost all events and actions in a backward and downward looking direction. And what I'm encouraging you to do is to shift this attitude, this direction of this attitudinal direction into a more solutions focused frame, an upward and exploratory direction, that this in the long run is far more productive and creative and will accomplish so much more. Now, we also looked yesterday at the first of Patrick Lencioni's five dysfunctions of a team, and in that we looked at trust, the lack of trust. Now, the backward positioning again was this looking back and down. It focused on problem justification versus solutions exploration, and we underscored the shifts that we can make in attitude and choice, and even those begin with physiological shifts and not only the psychological or attitudinal shifts. And the important thing is to remember that throughout all of this section on teams is that baby steps will in the long run make quantum leaps possible. In other words, keep at it. Now, again, this is the Lencioni model, and you can see here the most fundamental area of work that we can work on in our teams is that of developing trust, because the first dysfunction is the absence of trust. That dysfunction leads to the fear of conflict and the dysfunction in terms of being able to embrace and engage in difference and, in fact, to enjoy the tensions and difference that often we look at as conflicts instead. And then this leads to the lack of commitment, accountability, and it, in the end, results we do not get. So let's go on into the second dysfunction and look at where we're going to look at the fear of tension and difference. Now, teams that fear conflict have boring meetings. They create environments where back channel politics and personal attacks thrive. They ignore controversial topics that are critical to team success. And they fail to tap into all the opinions and perspectives of team members. Stop and think about that point alone sometimes. Who do you have on your team? What is the depth of experience and perspective that lies latent within each person that is on that team, much of which often we do not know or are unaware, unless there are opportunities, unless we create those opportunities to allow us to tap into all of those perspectives. And add this point, even when every perspective of every person is not totally magnificent, sometimes it is the contrast of perspectives that stimulates thought, insight, and the evolution of new and more innovative thoughts and understanding. That failure can be enormous. Add to that the wasted time and energy that goes on with posturing and interpersonal risk management that often we call group politics. Now, teams that embrace conflict have lively, interesting meetings. They extract and exploit the ideas of all team members. They solve the real problems very quickly. They don't get sidetracked on issues that mean that people have to come back again and again, meeting after meeting, to the same agenda, because in fact the last meeting did not deal with the real problem. Politics are minimized, and the critical topics are put on the table for discussion. How many times have you gone into a meeting and know that the really essential topic is not being put on the table, precisely because everybody in the room, or at least the key people in the room, are unwilling to deal with the conflict that they feel would arise because of that, or because of the politics? Now, there are tools for teams to overcome conflict, but first of all, the team has to come to a point where they understand that conflict, or active engagement and discussion and dialogue over differences, is not a waste of time. In fact, time is wasted if the differences of opinion and perspective are not brought out into the open and discussed and brought to some kind of a resolution. Plenty of time is wasted when people fear the differences and conflict. So one of the things that needs to be done, in fact, is to mine for difference. And what that means is that someone almost needs to be assigned the role in meetings to extract the buried disagreements within the team. Because if the discussion continues on and the differences remain unaddressed, they will simply surface later on, and any of the seeming progress that's been made by the team discussions up until that point will need to be undone, because people will go back and need to rehash out the differences and the perspectives in order to get onto the same page all over again. And that same page may be different than what it was when those differences were buried. And that means then that the work forward from that will need to be redone. So it is a time saver to mine for difference, to discover and uncover those disagreements within the team. They need to be brought into the light of day. But people have to have the courage and the confidence to call out these sensitive issues and force the team to work through them. This is not simple and it's not easy, but if the whole team recognizes the value of doing this and the team is in agreement that this is what they will do. In other words, real-time permission is given for that to take place in meetings, then extraordinary progress can be made. So one of the tools may be that some teams may want to assign a member of the team to take on this responsibility during a given meeting or discussion, that that's their role and their responsibility. And again, that real-time permission to engage rather than to retreat is given. So that may mean at the beginning of the meeting that everyone is reminded that this is one of the objectives, one of the determinations of the group as a whole for that to take place during a particular meeting. Now, this may not happen in all meetings. Not all meetings are there for in-depth discussions. Some are there to convey very specific types of information. But for those meetings that do have on their agenda the resolution, the dealing with these, with a particular topic that is meant to move forward, then real-time permission can be given. And so, a simple but effective way to do this is to recognize that when people engage in conflict are becoming uncomfortable with the level of discord, then simply interrupt everybody and remind them that what is being done is necessary. We do need to be reminded. Just because it's been said before doesn't mean to say it's not helpful to say it again. So again, get real-time permission. Give that person the time to adjust to acknowledging that, yes, this is uncomfortable, but yes, more than the discomfort, I recognize the value of digging into this difference. And yes, I'm willing to work through this with you. Allow people to be human in the process of this conflict. What is also helpful, as was mentioned in the previous lesson, was learning more about how different personality types function, how different individuals have different innate characteristics that have different ways of going about doing and accomplishing things. Some need to focus on research. Others are ready to leap forward. Some are comfortable with making a rational decision. Others have to feel right about it. And any of these ways are not necessarily right or wrong, but they are different. And by understanding the differences of personality types and of understanding the value of the different personality types in different situations and circumstances, can allow us to be different without seeing it as a negative and as a put down or as something that detracts from, but rather is and can be a contribution. Now, in all of this, the role of the leader is to love the wrestling, to value these moments of difference and of difficulty almost, and to appreciate and to find ways to appreciate and to bring that appreciation to the team as a whole and to value the team of the whole. In other words, to love wrestling. Now, how does this connect with the next dysfunction? Well, without engaging in authentic dialogue, not just skipping over the parts that we feel uncomfortable with, but engaging in authentic dialogue, wrestling with the issues and working through them and allowing synergy to actually take place, then we simply settle for a version of consensus that is superficial. We settle for a disunited version of certainty, and this leads to a team that fails to commit. There's no basis for genuine, authentic commitment because nobody feels, or very few of those feel, that their contribution, their perspective, the things that they value and understand, see, or believe, or feel are valuable, have any place in what perhaps was articulated through that inauthentic or disingenuous conversation. And people cannot commit to things that they feel is a disingenuous. So what happens is there is ambiguity that's created amongst the team about direction and priorities. Without that commitment, people watch windows of opportunity open and close due to excessive analysis and unnecessary delay because the real issues are not being dealt with. The dialogue is not authentic. And there's a lack of confidence and a fear of failure because people are not able to engage properly. Discussions and decisions on core issues are revisited time and again, and they keep getting put on the table, but never genuinely removed because they're not dealt with in an authentic way. People continue to second guess what other people really think because, again, the authentic discussions are not allowed to take place when people, quote unquote, fear conflict. Now, a team that commits creates clarity around direction and priorities. They align the entire team around common objectives. They develop an ability to learn from mistakes. They take advantage of opportunities, and they move forward without hesitation because they know and they're confident they can revisit things authentically when it is needed. That time of confidence means also that the team, as a team, they move forward in the wrong direction, then they realize that direction is wrong. Everybody as a team can change direction without hesitation or guilt because they know that there's not second guessing, they know there's not finger pointing, there's not particular blame on one or the other. But as a team, they had it gone that way. Then as a team, they recognize the limitations of that direction. And as a team, they come to a new consensus and they move forward on that without hesitation or guilt. Now, tools used by a team that commits are cascading messages, deadlines, contingency, and worst-case scenario planning. And let's go briefly into each of these. So cascading messaging, it's actually one of the most valuable disciplines that a team can learn how to do. And it really just takes a few minutes, but it can save enormous amounts of aggravation and time. So at the end of a meeting, what the team should do is explicitly review the key decisions that were made during the meeting and agree upon what needs to be communicated and to whom. What happens is people often discover that not everybody's on quite the same page that everyone thought. So this final piece of work, the cascading messaging that clarifies what the outcomes were of the meeting and who is to get what information, and to clarify any of the specific outcomes before people go out and start to put them into action, is very important for clarifying commitment and ensuring efficiency. Now, deadlines. As simple as it seems, one of the best tools for ensuring commitment is the use of clear deadlines. When work is to be completed and or when the next decisions that need to be made will be made. Now, holding to those dates with a firmness will strengthen the team's commitment. The worst enemy of a team in this area is ambiguity. And timing is perhaps the most important factor that needs to be made clear. Now, what's important here are not just the big decisions and the big dates, but many of the intermediate, the smaller, the milestones in preparation for those big events. They are just as important. Misaligning those amongst the team members will lead to, again, confusion, ambiguity, and it will water down any kind of commitment that there may be. Next, contingency and worst-case scenario planning. When a team struggles with commitment, you can help to overcome that by working on contingency plans up front and letting people know what the consequences are for not committing. That's a natural way that is practical, useful, and also helps people clearly see when certain things do not work as planned, what will have to be done to deal with that. In other words, your contingency plans. This is also a tool that can be used to help a team be more clear in its commitment. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen in the course of one meeting. So consider this part of the process. Remember, baby steps are the things that allow quantum leaps to take place. Now, how does all of this relate to the next dysfunction and the avoidance of accountability? In order for teammates to call each other on their behaviors and actions, they've got to have a clear sense of what is expected, of what has been agreed upon. Now, even those who really believe in accountability, unless there is clarity of those standards, then there's nothing much that can be done. A team that avoids accountability is going to be described as a team that creates resentments amongst team members who have different standards of performance. It's almost inevitable that left alone without clarity of common standards, there are going to be different standards of acceptable performance within the group. When there is not that agreed upon standard of performance for the team as a whole, those who make extra effort and do the work to perform better begin to resent the others on the team. And this begins to undermine the effectiveness of the team as a whole. And as a result of that, there is also tends to be over time a movement or a shift in the team performance toward mediocrity, as those who originally made the most effort begin to decrease their efforts because they feel like, well, why should I when everybody else is not doing their portion of the work? And so the overall effectiveness of the team declines. Natural consequence of that is deadlines and key deliverables are missed. The dates come, the dates go. And then what is even worse for the team leader is there is an undue burden placed upon that person as the sole source of discipline. Now, the essence of this dysfunction of avoiding accountability is really the unwillingness of team members to tolerate discomfort from one another, not wanting to upset the apple cart in any way, shape, or form, and feeling uncomfortable about calling their peers to task on certain standards and issues. However, when the team as a whole has agreed that this is the way they will go forward, that this is an agreed upon reality and even is willing to help one another through the discomfort and is aware of the discomfort on both sides, then it's far more doable. Of course, it's easier said than done, but again, this is an area that can be worked on, and the value of this kind of peer pressure in the positive sense is that it can seriously reduce the bureaucracy that surrounds the management of teams. And in the end, as difficult as those moments might be, it is far less annoying and inconvenient than if the accountability is not done by the team itself and has to be done by some kind of outside source that really doesn't understand the nature of what's going on inside the team. Again, for all of the discomfort of dealing with this dysfunction of wanting to avoid accountability, to overcome this dysfunction and to welcome the difficulty is actually a shortcut to avoiding much greater difficulties and problems over the long haul. Now, a team, on the other hand, that holds one another accountable ensures that poor performers feel the pressure to improve. They identify the potential problems quickly by questioning one another's approaches without hesitation and without taking it as a personal affront. But because, again, this is all seen as part of a virtual contract of the team, an agreement, a covenant amongst those who are part of the members. And in the end, it establishes respect among team members who are held to the same high standards. Those who more naturally in that area have higher standards won't feel resentment toward others, and those who are tasked to upgrade their standards will in the end feel the satisfaction and the pride of accomplishing new standards and expanding new capacities. Now, tools that can help build accountability are in the end quite simple. They are the publication both of goals and of standards, so that they are clear. They're on paper, they're distributed to all of those on the team, and if there are questions, if there are queries, these again can be brought to the team as a whole, and anything that is misunderstood or not quite clarified, those differences or disagreements again can be mined, brought to the surface, and then resolved in the group. Another action that could be taken is to have simple and regular progress reviews. When reviews are part of the natural routine and not just brought up when a problem arises, then the problem of negatively as a way of dealing with problems, as a form of punishment, means that reviews are not able to be utilized in their more productive and positive way. Their use as a constructive feedback mechanism is lost, as is the opportunity to gain greater clarity and insight as to where we as individuals need to focus in order to develop our skills and capacities and abilities. And when they are done in this routine manner and not just as a form of punishment, but as a form of nurturance, feedback, and support, then they can be amazingly powerful. Another action that can help accountability is to shift away from giving individual rewards to providing team rewards. And I think that you can see the obvious benefit to that. Now, the team leader needs to encourage and allow the team as a whole to serve as the first and primary accountability mechanism. In other words, the work of accountability shouldn't default to the team leader first. It should be first the work of the team to provide that, and when either gets too difficult or that is not working, then the team leader would need to step in, but should not be the front line for accountability. And so how does this lack of accountability, the accountability dysfunction, relate to dysfunction number 5 and that of results? Well, let's take a look. Now, if teammates are not being held accountable for their own contributions, they're going to be much more likely to turn their attention to their own needs, their own department's needs, or something else other than the group objectives. And an absence of accountability is a simple invitation to team members to shift their attention to areas other than that of collective results. And in the end, if the results are not being focused on, you could ask, why has the team been formed? So what does happen to teams not focused on results? They stagnate and they fail to grow. They lose achievement-oriented members. They encourage team members to focus on their own careers and individual goals or that of their departments. And they are easily distracted. Now, a team that's focused on results retains its achievement-oriented members. They minimize the individualistic behaviors that undermine the focus on results. And a team like that actually together enjoys the success and suffers the failures acutely and collectively. Now, a team that is focused on results also benefits from individuals who subjugate their own goals and interests for the good of the team, and they avoid distractions. Now again, these things oftentimes sound like some of the soft stuff, but don't underestimate these soft issues for being very powerful in enabling, empowering, and ensuring that results are achieved. What are some of the tools that help teams focus on results? The public declaration of results, when results are achieved, and sometimes even when they're not achieved. Make it very clear. Make results-based rewards. The leader also must set the tone themselves for a focus on results, and they need to hone in on that, focus on that, and lead that process. The long and short of these 5 dysfunctions and converting them into 5 passions that teams need to have in order to be highly functional is that you'll end up with a strong team that is delighted to spend time together. They will have eliminated the vast amounts of confusion, minimized redundant effort and communications, and therefore will have reached the desired goals faster, better, cheaper, more enjoyably, and much more fulfilled. Now, we ended up having to go through this really quite quickly. I would strongly urge you to go back and get Patrick Lencioni's book for those of you who are at all involved in creating teams and want to have them not just be time wasters, but really be high producers and exciting and fun. Then do go and find that book. And I'm going to add some additional recommended reading here. And that includes going back to the very well-known 1-Minute Manager. Go back and read it. There are some real gems in that book. It doesn't matter whether you're an NGO, whether you're a social enterprise or a nonprofit or a for-profit. They're excellent reading and excellent resources. Now there's a couple more. The Leader's Guide to Storytelling, Jim Collins' From Good to Great. You can find some of these online as well as in books and resources. And of course, one of the classics is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. These are just some additional reading that I would encourage you to do if you have a chance or an interest. With that, where I'm going to give you just some tiny bit of homework, and that is to review the 6 dysfunctions so that you're more familiar with them. You might like to think, how can awareness of the solutions-focused frame help keep you on track with each of the 5 team dysfunctions? And then I want you to pick one tool of one dysfunction that you can investigate and see how it might help your teams develop new strengths. Just explore it more. Just take 5 minutes to go and read up on about it, go back into the notes or go to Amazon and you'll find that link right below. Go in and look at the Read Me Now segment of the Amazon and read a few notes. And if that doesn't encourage you to buy the book, then at least learn from those bits and pieces that you're able to pull out of that. I'm confident, no matter who you are, being able to create more effective, exciting, and focused teams will save you time, energy, and grief throughout many years. And with that, I look forward to seeing you for our very final lesson in this advocacy algorithm.